so hot, so hot, so hot, so what, so hot, so what, so hot, so hot. They made a mistake. I got more than I usually take. I got food stamps, food stamps. I got so many stamps in the mail, I thought maybe I should put them on sale. How lucky I am. I got food stamps, hot damn. I made up my mind to be decent and kind, to let my upright character shine. I sent 10,000 food stamps back to the president and his beautiful wife. And I can't pay the rent, but I sent 10,000 food stamps back to the president and his beautiful wife. How lucky I am. I got food stamps. Hot damn. They made a mistake, for Christ's sake, and I gave it away to the president. I thought that was legal. I thought that was kind, and I can't pay the rent, but I sent 10,000 food stamps back to the president. So hot, so hot, so hot, so what, so hot, so what, so hot, so hot. Trucks cruising down the avenue carrying nuclear...
Song of the Law of the Abiding Citizen. And of the law-abiding citizen. And that was read and written by the great June Jordan, who was born on this day in 1936, one of our great poets, essayists, teachers, activists, writers, thinkers, a woman who took our views of life and politics and the world around us and our sexuality to heights that we didn't think about. And so we celebrate her in this part of the Mark Steiner Show, the amazing June Jordan, with the two great guests here. We're honored to have in the studio Pamela Johnson, who is a poet, retired librarian, a dancer, who joins us in studios. We have this looking from generations apart here about the great June Jordan, because also in the studio with us is Michelle Antoinette, a.k.a. Love the Poet, indie spoken word artist, musician on national performance, literary art scenes, and author of Black Marks on White Paper. Good to have you both here in the studio.
Okay, good. Thank you for having us. Yes.
410-319-8888 is the number here. You can write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. You can tweet me at Mark Steiner. Jump onto my Facebook pages on the Mark Steiner Show or Mark Steiner. 410-319-8888. Your thoughts about June Jordan, maybe her favorite essay, her favorite thoughts, her favorite poem of yours, 410-319-8888. And Pamela Johnson, it really is wonderful to have you here.
It's good to be here.
Really good to have you here. Talk a bit about, your discovery of June Jordan and what you think she means to you and the rest of us.
I was first introduced to June Jordan by my professor at Morgan, Nick Aaron Ford. He taught African-American literature here. It was back in the 60s. And I was first introduced to her there. But to be honest with you, I forgot about June Jordan for a long, long time. It wasn't until I happened to run across her book, Soldier, a memoir of a poet child.
Oh, that was an amazing book.
Yes, and it wasn't until then that I rediscovered her. And but she's just a powerful, unflinching kind of poet. Or was a very powerful, unflinching kind of poet. And thank goodness she left 27 volumes for us to continue to read her words and read her thoughts and her ideas. And as a librarian, of course, I will always be pushing books. I'm sorry. That's me. So
that's a wonderful crime to commit.
That's right.
So in terms of what you just said, the book you talked about, that was the book that she wrote that was about, if I remember correctly, was about her father being both the most important person in life and a tyrant at the same time.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. And he was. He at times left bruises, scars on her. He had very high standards for her in terms of her being strong and in terms of her being academically inclined. She started writing poetry when she was very, very young. But her father... Sometimes it seemed like no matter what, because of his own frustration about being a black man in America, he was, like his wife, both of them were Jamaican immigrants. He was very frustrated. And in reading the book, you could very easily see that he did take it out on her.
And I thought that book to me, about, we'll move on to something else about her, but that book to me, what was so amazing about that book was she could see... She didn't justify the physical pain that he inflicted upon her, but she could see beyond that to see the beauty in him and understand that we do the best we can do in this existence, and we have to. Which is why she just did in ways I thought were just poetically beautiful that few people could do, the way yes. she wrote that.
And it was basically a prose poem.
It was a prose poem,
it was like
exactly.
a prose poem.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And sometimes you would think you were just reading paragraphs, and then all of a sudden she would just start writing verse.
Right.
And it was just beautiful.
Like
and
she broke out into it in the middle of her writing.
Yes, right in the
just
middle.
Just hit her, right? So I'm curious, good to always have you here.
Hey, it's good to be here.
So let me ask this question. I mean, June Jordan died 16 years ago, I think, if I have that right.
Mm-hmm.
I know you weren't a baby, but you were a young woman, really young woman at that point. So tell me when you first stumbled onto June Jordan and what that was for
well,
you.
Well, 16 years ago, I was 17. And I hadn't yet, I ended up going to Coppin State, then college, now university, when I was 18. And while I was there, I became an RA, a resident assistant, and I would do poetry events for my programming requirements. And so I had a brother there by the name of David Ross, who goes by
oh, sure.
Native Son.
Right. Sure.
That's where we met. And he would bring Poetry for the People, Baltimore, to my events. And this was Olu Butterfly Woods and Akil Maizan and E the Poet MC and Femi the Dry Fish, you know, just a number of people who are now, you know, renowned and all wonderful things. But Poetry for the People Baltimore was actually founded in 2001 with the permission of June Jordan, you know, to do that. Or the permission of the people who worked under, you know,
right.
June Jordan. And it was, that's when she became brought to my attention through Olu and the Poetry for the People Baltimore. And after I graduated, I actually joined Poetry for the People Baltimore. So that's how I became affiliated with June Jordan's legacy.
There's something I want to just read, just because she had so much. She was a... there was a thing that was published in 2002, and I followed her work that this book came out of. She wrote in the Progressive. She had a column in the Progressive where she wrote, which is this political magazine that comes out of Wisconsin, and she wrote this in this book, Some of Us Did Not Die, new and selected essays from June Jordan, which were published around the time of her death, but they came out of what she wrote, and she really attacked. I mean, she had this deep political consciousness as well. It wasn't just about the beauty of life and sexuality. No. I mean, she was really somebody who wanted to raise her own consciousness and raise the consciousness of people around her and was dedicated yes. to black people and people of color and to liberation. I mean, that was a big part of who she was.
Yes, and she was also, she spoke for the oppressed.
She spoke for the oppressed.
Mm-hmm. And she spoke right. against the oppressor. And she didn't pull any punches. She spoke plain. She wasn't subtle. She said exactly what was on her mind and what she saw, and you have to admire that in her poetry, in her work, and whether it's an essay or whether it's a poem. So yes, she spoke for the people, and she also spoke about the abuse of power. She constantly touched on that in her work.
So let me ask you this. I'm going to read a piece here about one of the things that she wrote, and then I'm going to play another one of June Jordan, excerpt from June Jordan. We'll see what we play next. And here's something that you may have written as well, our poets that are in-house here. As we remember June Jordan, one of the, I think, most important writers in modern political literature. I mean, she was just, to me, very key to our culture. But let me read this, what she wrote. Let's see if I have this down right. She said... this is an essay she wrote, a couple of words on behalf of sex itself. She wrote, let me see if I got this right. Where did I... There. Okay, so like, I just lost what I was about to write. Oh, here we go. Okay, got it. So that people think about, she writes about homosexuality, but she wrote about her own kind of bisexuality a lot. And she said, in love and the defense of concrete beauty of sexual experience and desire, in typically, I mean, she wrote, some of the stronger pieces here address the vast complex of injustice. Oh, this is another right piece. Let me turn to your poems and I'll find the piece that I picked out, but I can't find my piece that I wanted to share with you all. I found it, but first... Sorry about that mumbling there, stumbling. Let me ask you two to pick out the pieces from June Jordan that you loved that you would like to share.
Okay. You can go. Please go.
Okay. Yes, ma'am. This piece is called Jim Crow, the Sequel.
Ah, yes.
Yes. That's a very powerful piece. I was like, I have to read this one. An Angry Black Woman on the Subject of the Angry White Man. We didn't always need affirmative action. When we broke this crazy land into farms, when we planted and harvested the crops, when we dug into the earth for water, when we carried that water into the big house, kitchens and bedrooms, when we built that big house, when we fed and clothed other people's children with food we cooked and served to other people's children, wearing the garments that we fitted and we sewed together, when we hacked and hauled huge trees for lumber and fuel, when we washed and polished the chandeliers, when we bleached and pressed the linens purchased by blood profits from our daily forced laborings, when we lived under the whip and in between the coffle and chains, when we watched our babies sold away from us, when we lost our men to anybody's highest bidder, when slavery defined our days and our prayers and our night times of no rest, then we did not need affirmative action. Like two-legged livestock, we cost the boss man $315 or $675, so he provided for our keep. Like two-legged livestock, penned into the parched periphery of a very grand plantation life, we did not need affirmative action. No, we needed freedom. We needed overthrow, revolution, and a holy fire to purify the air. But for 200 years, this crazy land, the law and the bullets behind the law continue to affirm the gospel of God-given white supremacy. For 200 years, the law and the bullets behind the law and the money and the politics behind the bullets behind the law affirm the gospel of God-given white supremacy, God-given male white supremacy, and neither the Emancipation Proclamation, nor the Civil War, nor one constitutional amendment after another, nor one civil rights legislation after another could bring about a yielding of the followers of that gospel to the beauty of our human face. Justice don't mean nothing to a hateful heart. And so we needed affirmative action. We needed a way into the big house besides the back door. We needed a chance at the classroom and jobs and open housing and okay neighborhoods. We needed a way around the hateful hearts of America. We needed more than freedom, because a piece of paper ain't the same as opportunity or education. And some 30 years ago, we agitated and we agitated until the president said, we seek not just equality as a right and a theory, but equality as a fact and as a result. And a great rejoicing rose like a spirit dancing, fresh and happy on the soon to be the integrated and most uppity ballroom floor of these United States, and black folks everywhere dressed up in African-American pride and optimism. From the littlest to the elders, we shined our shoes and brushed our hair and got good and ready for equality as a fact. But 3 decades later, and come to find out, we never got invited to the party. We never got included in the people. We never got no kind of affirmative action worth more than a spit in the wind. And yesterday, the new man in the White House, the new president, declared what we have done for women and minorities is a good thing, but we must respond to those who feel discriminated against. This is a psychologically difficult time for the so-called angry white man. Well, I am here to tell the world that 46% of my children living in poverty does not feel good to me, and my brothers in prison and not in college does not feel good to me psychologically or otherwise. Catch that angry white man and tell him, get a grip. 46% of the American labor force is constituted by white men, and white men occupy 95% of all senior management positions. And as a wise black man recently observed, this supposedly beleaguered minority, white males are about 1/3 of the population, makes up 80% of the Congress, 4/5 of tenured university faculty, 9/10 of the Senate, and 92% of the Forbes 400. Tell me who's angry. I say the problem with affirmative action seems to be like way too much affirmative talk and way too little action. And unless you happen to belong to the infinitesimal club of millionaire black folks got $108,000 to throw into the campaign pot of their nearest and dearest full-time political racist, I think you better join with me to agitate and agitate for justice and equality we can eat and pay rent with now.
Good choice, Sister Love. Good choice.
I love that.
Pamela Johnson, what do you have for us?
Okay, poem about my rights. And as I said before, she pulls no punches. She says exactly what's on her mind. Sis she was a fierce person.
She was that.
She was
fierce. Yes, she was.
Poem about my rights. Even tonight, and I need to take a walk and clear my head about this poem about why I can't go out without changing my clothes, my shoes, my body posture, my gender identity, my age, my status as a woman, alone in the evening, alone on the streets, alone not being the point. The point being that I can't do what I want to do with my own body because I am the wrong sex, the wrong age, the wrong skin. And suppose it was not here in the city, but down on the beach or far into the woods. And I wanted to go there by myself, thinking about God or thinking about children or thinking about the world, all of it disclosed by the stars and the silence. I could not go and I could not think and I could not stay there alone as I need to be alone because I can't do what I want to do with my own body. And who in the hell set things up like this? And in France, they say if the guy penetrates but does not ejaculate, then he did not rape me. And if after stabbing him, if after screams, if after begging the bastard, and even after smashing a hammer to his head. Do you follow me? We are the wrong people of the wrong skin on the wrong continent, and what in the hell is everybody being reasonable about? And according to the Times this week, back in 1966, the CIA decided that they had this problem. And the problem was a man named Nkrumah. So they killed him, and before that it was Patrice Lumumba, and before that it was my father on the campus of my Ivy League school. And my father afraid to walk into the cafeteria because he said he was wrong. The wrong age, the wrong skin, the wrong gender identity, and he was paying my tuition. And before that, it was my father saying I was wrong, saying that I should have been a boy because he wanted one, a boy, and that I should have been lighter skinned, and that I should have had straighter hair, and that I should not be so boy crazy, but instead I should be one, a boy. And before that, it was my mother pleading plastic surgery for my nose and braces for my teeth, and telling me to let the books loose, to let them loose. In other words, I'm very familiar with the problem of the CIA and the problems of South Africa and the problems of the Exxon Corporation and the problems of white America in general and the problems of the teachers and the preachers and the FBI and the social workers and my particular mom and dad. I am very familiar with the problems because the problems turn out to be me. I am the history of rape. I am the history of the rejection of who I am. I am the history of the terrorized incarceration of myself. I am the history of battery assault and limitless armies against whatever I want to do with my mind and my body and my soul. And whether it's about walking out at night or whether it's about the love that I feel or whether it's about the sanctity of my vagina or the sanctity of my national boundaries, or the sanctity of my leaders, or the sanctity of each and every desire that I know from my personal and idiosyncratic and indisputably single and singular heart, I have been raped because I have been wrong. The wrong sex, the wrong age, the wrong skin, the wrong nose, the wrong hair, the wrong need, the wrong dream, the wrong geographic, the wrong sartorial. I have been the meaning of rape. I have been the problem everyone seeks to eliminate by forced penetration, with or without the evidence of slime. But let this be unmistakable. This poem is not consent. I do not consent to my mother, to my father, to the teachers, to the FBI, to South Africa, to Bedford Stuy, to Park Avenue, to American Airlines, to the hardened idlers on the corners, to the sneaky creeps in cars. I am not wrong. Wrong is not my name. My name is my own, my own, my own. And I can't tell you who the hell set things up like this, but I can tell you that from now on, my resistance, my simple and daily and nightly self-determination may very well cost you your life.
Mm.
That is a very important piece to pull that, Pamela Johnson, because I mean, she pulled no punches about anything. She was out there, and in terms of saying what she thought had to be said about her own sexuality, that the power of desire, and we shouldn't diminish our desire for sex, and we should enjoy it and relish in it, with, no matter who it was with, our ability to liberate the planet and end oppression. She was just, whatever it was, she just laid it out
she
there
took
in words.
It on.
She took it on.
Yes, she did.
And she just said, the way you read it, that just made me think of just that her words. I can still hear her voice, you know, in my head as she did this work. She was an incredible person. I'll read as we close. I'm just going to read this piece that she put out about why she's a poet. And she wrote, the role of the poet, beginning with my childhood experience, is to deserve the trust of people who know that what you do is work with words. Always to be as honest as possible and to be careful about the trust invested in you as you possibly can. Then the task of a poet of color, a black poet, as a people hated and despised, is to rally the spirit of your folks. I have to get myself together and figure out an angle, a perspective, that is an offering that other folks can use to pick themselves up, to rally and to continue, or even better, to jump higher, to reach more extensively in solidarity with even more varieties of people to accomplish something. I feel that it's a spirit task.
Yes, she writes about why.
So we are going to remember June Jordan and do more with her in the coming time, because she's a poet. As I said, I think that she's somebody who is one of the most important figures in 20th century literature in the world. And passed away much too early from breast cancer in 2002.
Yes.
She would only be 78 years old if she was with us today. She was alive to celebrate her birthday with us today, and she'd be still out there fighting and writing and bringing her beauty and power to the stage. And it was a treat and a pleasure to finally meet you, Pamela Johnson. It's an honor to have you in my studio.
Well, thank you for having me. And I will say that you probably don't remember me, but I was at your dinner that you gave for supporters of WEAA.
No, I remember that, but I'm sure you've never been in my studio before, though.
Guest.
Guest. And I hope this won't be the last time you'll join us as we explore ourselves for our work. And it's always great, Michelle Antoinette, love the poet in the house. Always great to have you. Thank you so much.
Love being here, Mark.
And I thought it was important also that we talked about to have the generations of women talking about June Jordan and what they represent across the spectrum, from elders to our young thinkers.
Yeah. So her work is extremely powerful, and I know personally I'm going to delve more into it and see what else I can glean from her work.
Maybe we should just do a whole June Jordan hour and talk about the essence of who she is and really get into it one day sometime in the fall.
That'd be amazing.
We'll come back and do that.
Yes.
Thank you both so much for being with us here to celebrate the life of June Jordan. Today was the day of her birth, 1936.
Thank you both so much.
We can take a brief break, and we are going out here with what? Gwen Guthrie, born on this day. Ain't nothing going on but the rent. We're coming back with a conversation about what we are just finding out about what the National Security Agency is doing around us and to us and what they have on us. Why? What's up? We'll be back with that. Stay with us. Leave another. You got to have.